Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 1031. Come on out to Irvine, the Irvine Improv. I'm doing stand-up November 15 and 16. That's a Friday and Saturday. And then December 12, 13, 14 in Tacoma, Washington at the Tacoma Comedy Club. And I have a tour next year, a bunch of dates. So I'll be announcing that very soon. If you go to id10t.com/tour, that will give you those dates. Or you can just Google those respective clubs if you feel like it. Come on, it'd be nice to see you. Come on out. Let's talk about what you're doing, though, in the ID10T community. Events at ID10T.com, like Ken, who writes, I created a stained glass artwork for you, Chris, that I sent a while back. The Enjoy Your Burrito piece with you and Reggie Watts. Oh, yes, thank you, Ken. He goes on to say, my father-in-law and mentor taught me how to do it and supplied the material and shipping. He is far more talented than I, and I'd like to plug some of his current work. Scott Outerkirk is a celebrated stained glass artist who is doing a lot of really creative and diverse stuff. Your listeners should check out his YouTube series about building and restoring old wooden boats on the St. Lawrence River called The Wooden Boat Experience. That sounds awesome. He also created various handcrafted goods he sells through his shop, Glass Goat, on Etsy. His daughter also makes and sells awesome soy candles through Glass Goat Soy Candles on Etsy as well. I recommend everyone check out Scott Outerkirk's beautiful stained glass works like The Queen and consider supporting his other work if it strikes their fancy. Ken, thank you so much for the piece that you made for me. And I will definitely check out Scott's work, especially the boat stuff. That sounds, oh my God, restoring an old wooden boat. Oh God. I love it. I'm gonna finish recording this. I'm gonna jump right onto that, and then I'm gonna get obsessed with restoring wooden boats, I'm sure, which is something I never knew I wanted until I just read that sentence. This episode is David Boreanaz, who is promoting not only season 3 of SEAL Team Wednesday nights at 9 on CBS, but also the 20th anniversary of Angel, which is a show that if you listen to this podcast, you are probably somewhat familiar with. All available episodes are on Hulu. And, he was great. I knew it. I knew he was going to be a nice dude because he has worked so much in the last 22-23 years. And as I say in the podcast, it's not an accident. Usually when someone works job after job, hit show after hit show, there's an element of they're probably a nice dude. And he was. So this is a very, very, very fun episode. And I hope you enjoy the ID10T podcast number 1031 with Mr. David Boreanaz. And let us begin the thing.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
Microphones check. I hope it's not embarrassing that I'm wearing a Sunnydale shirt. I thought with the anniversary coming up that it may
already had it.
It did have it.
We happened. The anniversary went down and happened, and it was a. It's always a experience. That's for sure. I didn't get a chance to. I'm lost in your wallpaper. As I kind of sit here and talk about the Angel's 20th anniversary.
My wife's the wallpaper maven.
Good choice.
Like she's the one.
Stuff that puts everything up ready to
go. She's the one that finds all the wallpapers.
Yeah.
And so I tend to like, she's good with furniture, but furniture is really my specialty.
Mm-hmm.
And her specialty is colors, wallpaper, drapery, fabric. Like she just finds all these seemingly extinct fabrics and wallpapers.
It looks cool. I like it.
What style is your house?
Well, we're actually redoing our home right now. So we're completely doing a major tear down. The whole property is going to be leveled. We're not living in there. I wanted to live in an Airstream down at the bottom, but my wife's like, that's not going to happen. that would not happen.
Sean Penn style. I would easily
could have done it. You know, it's easy for men to be like, yeah, I'll live in an Airstream or wherever. And then, the wife is usually like, now I need a closet and I need, like, you know, a facility that's a bathroom with at least, you know, running water that doesn't stop and
it
hot
shower. It sounds more charming to do the Airstream than it actually is. I think day to day, oh my God, what if I go to a hotel? Let's just go to a hotel.
That's true, man.
Yeah.
So we're in the midst of doing that. So we rented a place, which is cool because it's like this circa 1987 place that we rented in. So it's all like it's intact. So you kind of feel like you're going back to just back into the 87 era with like an old movie or something. It's just has that whole kind of vibe going on. So
see, there's probably just 1987 Los Angeles, so probably just like bricks of cocaine in the walls.
It was completely bananas. There is a brick piece that's in the bathroom that makes me wonder. should we like knock some of it down?
Yeah, something I built in 87. Someone's trying to hide something in those walls.
It's got like the
walls.
Old wood banisters. It's got the old Thermidor ovens.
Oh,
and
nice.
You know, like the older ones when it first came out, and the refrigerator is still kicking, and it's great because it just makes things really cold. So I like cold milk and things that are cold beer. It can't be like cold. It's going to be cold on the verge of like that frost.
Mm-hmm.
So it just has a little bit of kind of tip of a slush on the top.
Almost a solid.
Yes.
But not quite.
Crisp. Very crisp. So we're kind of like living this, we're in the midst of moving right now, and that's always difficult when you're moving from one point to the other, and you get rid of stuff and you purge and you give things away, and then you also see boxes that you haven't opened up, and pictures always get you, so you always go back in time. I've just gone through so many different pictures of my past. It's like, it's crazy. Emotional, hilarious, you know, funny, and you're like, people you haven't seen in a long time. And it's I ran across this one box, and there was like 19 Polaroids or 20 of them of me and Glenn Quinn just like by a pint just drinking Guinness and hanging out. And for those who don't know Glenn Quinn, he played Doyle on Angel, who was a really dear friend of mine and ended up, you know, dying and of a bad heroin overdose, but great friend of mine. Still, you know, he's someone I can't really kind of let go in my life.
Sure.
And interesting. So but I saw that, and you know, like, when you're moving, you see these pictures and these things, and you're kind of like, wow, this, it just kind of hits you, you know? You kind of, you remember all those times that you had, and when you're there, you don't think about how time goes by so fast.
No, especially when you're
flies.
Young.
Yeah, especially when you're young.
Because you just
fun.
Feel like, oh, this is, hey.
Yeah.
Forever. But having a physical, there really is something, having a tactile experience rather than, I mean, my iCloud photo thing has literally 75,000 pictures in it.
Whoa.
And they just go back like from the first iteration of the iPhone. And it's very rare do I go back. But when you go through a box and you find an old picture, it was like a milestone of that time period. There's just something, maybe it's just an old person thing to say, but it just feels like it means more and has more value when you can hold it.
Of course. And when you're looking at pictures of people that are no longer in your life or pictures that you'll never see again, and you just kind of relive that experience.
Sure.
And that moment is, it's just overwhelming sometimes. And on top of the moving, it's, you know, when you move, it's how many fights do you get into when you move with your better half?
Don't keep this.
Don't keep that. You're annoying me. Get away. Get out. Where are we going with this?
This
box
is my pile. Don't
just
touch
get rid
my
of
pile.
It. Don't touch my pile. Okay, you go over there. I'll go over here. You annoyed me 90 times.
I literally just went through this.
You
with
seriously
my wife.
Are like, okay, you've been divorced. You're back together again. You're divorced. You're back together again. Okay, we're fine. Now we're on a honeymoon. It's like you experience all everything. Death, divorce, it's all up there. Moving.
The entire relationship.
It's everything. All in one.
Well, my office was stacked full of stuff that I was going to move. And it just ended up – my office at home just ended up looking like a hoarder's closet.
Yeah.
And so my wife kept going – you know, I could just go in there and go, and I'm like, no, don't touch my stuff. And she was like, no, but you really need me to help you. And I go, no, I don't. And then in the end, of course, I did need her to help me.
Yep.
But you really do need someone to help you make some of those harder decisions. Because obviously, you know, you want to keep Polaroids of a friend you've lost. But like, oh, this coaster came from this really special.
No, but it has meaning. Because there's stuff written on the coaster. I have like cocktail napkins, bar napkins of my friends and I are writing scripts and movie lines. And like, I have a box of them. Like, it's not going anywhere. It's just like, it didn't really make much sense. But at the time, it was great. So, you know, all that stuff. ashtrays, and like I collect old ashtrays from hotels around the world. I have so many really cool ones, and you know, things like that, and you know, mugs and pine glasses, and you know, I think we have a similar love for antiques. Looking around this place is pretty cool.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, what was the hardest thing you actually got rid of?
Oh my God, that's tough. It's still happening. You know, I have a lot of shoes, but they're and suits, like older suits that I want to pass on to my son and let him have. Because I remember when I was growing up, I was like, my grandfather, who I spent a lot of time with in Buffalo, New York, you know, lived in – that was where my dad grew up. It was an older house, and I'd go up in the attic and look at all my grandfather's suits and be like, this is great, you know. So maybe that kind of leaked into me. And so I like suits and older shoes, and I still hold on to like the these great double-breasted suits from, you know, the late 80s. And I'm like, well, I really want to hold on to these because they're just time – I've worn them, and I want my son to kind of look at them because I don't want to just throw them away. So – I'm still holding on to them. They don't fit me, but shoes, suits, ties, old like ties, yep. You know, all old vintage clothing, leather jackets. Jeez, forget it. I have.
Oh, I'm sure.
I'm sure. You know, me, I have tons of leather jackets. I was going through the closet today. I think I have Angel's original leather coat. And I was like, and I had two of them in my hand. I got to keep that, right? I was like, well, which one is it? Is it this one or that one? And I think it was a Hugo Boss who made it. But yeah, that was the original one. I'm like, we can't get rid of that. That's like, there's like fake blood stains on the inside collar.
That's a diary of that period of time. Someday, you know, 100 years from now, that you like you could. That could be in an – that would go for like
– Never know.
Yeah, you never know. That could go for 20 grand.
Or you could just kind of donate it, right?
To a museum.
Not even to a museum. It's like let it go.
Yeah.
So then somebody would pick it up and not even know that they're wearing that coat.
Oh, they should know, though, cool, because they'll be like, oh, there's like blood on here. I got to scrape this up.
Yeah, right? Or you put like a little note on the inside and then you donate it. And whoever buys it reads this note. Like, well, that's kind of – that's an authentic piece I just found.
Well, I think, you know, I think with old – props, like a fun thing to do at some point if someone could, you know, part with something, maybe there's something to part with, is just like, you know, have an auction for charity, because then you raise a bunch of money,
right,
and then someone that really wants it gets it,
and then
you don't have to deal with it anymore, and then everyone kind of wins. That to me is
true.
The way
but when you have your when you have kids, though, you want to pass it on to them, so then if they're blessed to have children, then you know it's kind of stays within the family.
Yeah, it's my dad's vampire jacket.
But I had don't give that up. But I got a pinball machine it was James Garner's pinball machine, and it was made for him from the movie Maverick, and I know his daughter very well, and she's like, oh, I got a bunch of stuff. And I said, well, I'll take the pinball machine. So I purchased that from her, and that is just a hard thing to move around. It's not easy. You can't just like move a pinball machine around. That thing takes at least six people to navigate that thing. But that's a cool piece that I have.
That's really cool.
Yeah, and it was never used. So it was made in his honor for the movie for Maverick, and it's just kind of, you know.
Yeah, basically we just turn into Steve Martin at the end of The Jerk. Like,
right,
I don't need one of – I need this.
I just want that. That's all I want.
All I need is the vampire jacket and the pinball machine.
Good luck trying to drag the pinball machine. I think the jacket would be fine, but it would take a lot of people to move that thing.
We do. We have pinball machines too, and they're fun, but I find – that you play them a lot for like the first couple weeks.
It's like bowling.
Yes.
You get bored after the sixth frame.
Yeah. Or like having a pool table. Oh, it'd be so fun to have a pool table. No. Then you play for like a month and then it just collects dust.
Bumper pool's cool. Remember bumper pool?
Of course I remember bumper pool.
One. That was actually kind of a cooler thing.
You
got to
get in
thing.
That little tiny hole
you
at
all
the end.
At the right same time, bam, you'd hit it off the corner and see who got it in close. And then you can just hit. If you were on a roll, you would just hit all the balls in. That
bumper
was
pool's cool.
That was a good. That's a lot better because it's smaller. It's not as big. Doesn't take up as much space.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to get a bumper pool now. That knowing I have this one space in the rent, I'm thinking this is a good spot for the bumper pool.
Honey, I know you made me get rid of a lot of stuff, but we now have enough room for a bumper pool.
And I took the bar that I made because you can't leave a bar behind.
No.
You don't want a bar to be destroyed.
Sure.
And so that was huge, and they got it. I couldn't believe it. I asked my friend Roberto to do it. He got like 6-7 guys in there, like just did it. And I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
It tore from the wall, and they just were pushing it through like the small little space and areas. And then they got to the rental, and they're going through the bushes, and it's like, well, we're almost there. And it's just juniper flying all over the place. It smells like Thanksgiving. It's crazy.
Three things that I've tried to explain to millennials to little to no success was... One was bumper pool. These are things that things that everyone had in the 70s. Bumper pool tables,
yeah.
Pachinko machines.
Yes.
And I try to explain organ stores. Mall had an organ store.
Right, they did.
And all the people who worked there could play. And so you'd walk into a mall and you'd hear dint, 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 dint. And then there would be like these tiered, because we went
there'd be tiers of them.
Tiers of them, because we went to the Maleficent premiere at the El Capitan, and then they have an organ player.
Of course, yeah.
Who comes out. My wife's like, oh, that thing's crazy. Uh-huh. And I go, you know, my wife's in her 30s, and I go, oh, well, every mall had one of these. And she's like, what? And I go, yeah, they had these organ stores. Everyone had a fucking organ with all these switches and all these crazy. And I'm like, but now that your phone can do that, it's a little less exciting.
Then it was in the mall. Then you went next door to Hickory Farms and you got the sausage with the hot mustard.
Orange Julius.
Yes. And the carpet stores that were rolled up. And as a kid, you'd climb on them and your mom would be like, I mean, I grew up in Buffalo, New York. So I saw a lot of those stores. But yeah, the organ was huge. But for me, it's hockey, so
it's the sound thing. It's the sound of the organ store, the smell of the Hickory Farms, the taste of the Orange Julius. That to me, those are the real, like, those bring out the mall
and
experience.
The champion t-shirts with the decals.
Oh, the vinyl, the smell of the vinyl.
Of course.
Where you pick out, like, oh yeah, I like hot rod cars, I'll get a shiny hot rod decal.
Man. And then you'd see it be burned on the, and then you'd be like, this is awesome. You get it on like 2 days later, it's bubbling and peeling.
Oh my god, listen,
like, I got a sunburn, it's peeling.
David, I have not known you very long, but I think we should pool some of our TV money and open a 70s mall.
I think that would be good, man. That's a good idea. There's a lot of property out in Westlake that needs to be used up right now.
I think that'd be fun to just build a small community. I wonder if that's going to happen at some point, where people who... It's sort of like the plot of The Village, that M. Night Shyamalan movie, where they moved out to be away from technology. But rather than moving into, like, you know, pilgrim times, we move into just pick an era like the 70s, where we have some technology,
but not much
of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have enough to cook and eat and have plumbing.
Sure, we have Intellivision you can play. You can have all those things. You know, remember Dragon's Lair,
which was
the arcade game of everything.
Absolutely.
That was, I just put so many quarters in that machine.
Yep.
That and Donkey Kong was the best. I mean,
Dragon's Lair, I have some original cells from the animation of Dragon's Lair.
Really?
Yeah, it was done by a guy named Don Bluth, and it was like an original, like, that's when they first started screwing around with laser technology.
Yeah.
So, you know.
My friend was here last year at a hotel somewhere, and they actually, I think it was in Mexico, and they had the arcade Dragon's Lair in the lobby.
Oh my gosh.
I kid you not, and
awesome.
It was there. It's like, he's like, is this the game we used to play when we were kids in Buffalo, New York at the mall? And I'm like, yes, it's it. And there was like, you had the 1, 2, 3, 2, 1. Like, you had the whole technique in order to get the lair,
yep.
and the sword, and
yep.
you ride the horse.
Yep.
That was big.
That was my...
Water slides, too, were big.
I remember in sixth or seventh grade, we had to give a speech in class about something we were an expert at to teach other kids. And
Dragon's Lair.
Yes. This should just give you an idea of how popular I was in school. I gave... My speech was about how to beat Dragon's Lair, like,
cool.
to all the patterns. And so there were only, like, three other nerds in the class. This is before the internet, and we could all pool our resources. But, like, two or three other nerds in the class that had questions. Like, oh, the one board in the treasure room. Oh, well, that's up, down, left, right, you know. And so I would draw
the up, down.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I would draw the diagram on the board. And needless to say, I was a terminally unpopular kid. But that and Space Ace were the two, like, laser games.
Did you play Dungeons & Dragons?
Of course.
See, now that I didn't play Dungeons and Dragons, but when it first came out, like, the kid up the street had it, and they're like, you got to play this game. I'm like, what is this called? Dungeons and Dragons. And I'm like, wow, this has got to be kind of like almost like the forefront of like Atari or Pong. It's
of the mind.
Amazing. I'm like, where is it? It's like, here. Like, where? We got to go, like, it's like these dice and paper. I'm like, this is so boring. I'm sorry. I'm like expecting dragons to be moving around and like
they're dragons of the mind.
Did not work for me, but that was very popular.
It's had quite a resurgence now.
It has.
A lot of people are playing it now. I think also as a response to how isolating just playing a video game alone can be, you get a bunch of people in a room, they have to interact with each other, use their imagination, be resourceful. So it actually has a resurgence now.
I'm sure it does, as does everything in life. There's no lack of originality. There is a big resurgence of television shows, of movies. It's what's streaming, what's not. There's a lot going on.
Well, I'm sure, because I'm sure, especially with like, you know, I'm sure Joss always gets it up. When are you going to do a Firefly reboot? When are you going to do a Buffy reboot? Yeah. When are you going to do an Angel reboot?
Never.
You know, like, there's always a...
Not in this lifetime.
But this is what delights and fascinates me about you.
Yeah.
You have been on television since 1997 without a break.
Mm.
And that's that's a fucking incredible achievement.
It's a lot of pain
to go from Buffy to Angel to Bones to SEAL Team. Like every season you have a hit show on, and you should get an award for that. Like that doesn't happen.
I think the anatomy of a hit, if you want to call it a hit, is just like maintaining your sensibility about the work and your work effort is to me like the most important part of the whole journey and has been. I mean, I went to a private school, high school, all boys, and it was like, you know, Augustinian priest, you work, you had to memorize stuff. Growing up as a kid, my mom was like, you have to have a job, you have to work at the farmer's market. I worked every summer. So I created a work ethic that I translated into my work that I do today. And that just is, for me, it's just always been about work. Like I like to work. I love being around it. I love the people. I try to always necessarily just focus on that and everything else. I'm not a big person who's into the publicity market or going to red carpets or meeting this person or that person. You know, it's exhausting. I tried that and it's very daunting and people don't even know really how to talk to people. It's a very odd situation, but you know, to the work, it's all about effort. I was listening to something today. Ivana Chubbuck is like my guru. I've been working with her for over 20 years and she's my acting coach and we work together on everything. And it's just, again, her recipe is, it's one of the questions to her was, it says, do you like working with your students? Do you like working with the stars you've made? And she's like, well, I've worked with, you know, students who have lived with, you know, 8 people in a house. And it's like those people have broken house because certain people have work ethic. Is their ethic is constantly gearing towards making choices that are risky, right? Regardless if you succeed or fail, you need to always make a choice that's risky and out there and put yourself out there. And that's very scary for a lot of people, no matter what business you're in. I mean, I'm not a surgeon. You don't want to make a risky choice when you're open heart or something.
Cut that one.
Let's just try it. No, it ain't going to work real well. So, I mean, that's, I think, to me overall is really what it's about. It's about the work and it's tough. I mean, television is a grueling pace. I mean, I work on SEAL Team now and it's still 22 episodes. That's like
a lot.
Why are we still doing that formula? I mean, I look at people who are like, hey, I'm doing 13 episodes or 8 here. I'm on Netflix. And I'm like, wow, you can fucking swear. You have a fucking life. You can read a book. I'm still like 22 episodes. We're shooting it in 8 days. We'll shoot it in 7 days because we're so fast. And meanwhile, the crew's dying and everyone around is like, we can't wait to get the Thanksgiving break.
Right.
Just to get 3 days off.
Absolutely.
It's like, whoa. So it's been a journey and a blessing for one. And I don't continue. I just want to continue that. And I don't plan on stopping anytime soon.
Yeah, but you look at it and everything you've done. I mean, obviously Angel came out of Buffy, but Bones was different than Angel, and then SEAL Team is different than Bones. Yeah. And so you've really done a good job, because it would have been really easy, I imagine, to take another job that was like, oh, I should probably do some kind of fantasy or sci-fi thing.
Right.
And you jumped and did a network procedural.
Yeah.
And it worked really well.
Yeah.
You know, so at the time, were you faced with some of those choices? Did you have a lot of options and you said, oh, this one really makes sense to me? Or how did that...
I didn't really necessarily think that would be the cure. I was like, oh, I got to make a choice that is necessarily different from what I'm doing. I live my life. I wake up and wherever my environment is, it kind of is dictating the character choices in my life, since I play pretty much all the characters that infuses what's going on in my life, my relationships or whatever. So when Bones came along, it was – it was kind of like a free kind of, I always think it was like when you end a job, it's, or a long running series or a character's like, you know what, it gives your sense of freedom because you're very vulnerable and you're open to a lot of things and you see things a lot better and things just kind of fall into your lap. And of course you sit there and you say, well, I remember people saying, well, you should go for this role here. And this is a really cool role. And it's got a great cast. And I said, well, I like this other role that's kind of interesting called Bones. And, you know, we were the last pilot picked up when we shot it. And, you know, and they're like, well, this show is not going to go. It's silly. It's named Bones. I'm like, well, I kind of like the relationship and like the way the characters are talking to each other. It was very like Romancing the Stone.
Yes.
Genre to me. And a lot of people didn't see that, and I did, and I just kind of went into that arena. So for me, it's like, it's not a conscious choice. I think sure. It's just something that happens.
Sure.
And I don't want to be too like ethereal about it, but that's the way I am. You know, it just kind of happens, I'm going to go for this, right?
Right.
And, you know, it worked out, and I'm glad it did. And, you know, we were very successful in that show in creating characters that worked opposite of the procedural. I mean, when we started that show, Emily and I worked with Ivana for 8 or 9 episodes every weekend, rewriting stuff and bringing it to the producers and changing things and instituting things. And at first they wanted like a drama. They wanted like an X-Files. They want this mysterious thing. I'm like, it's not that. It's not funny. It's not, you know, quirky. And it was great to see after we had successfully broken those barriers 4 or 5 seasons later, other procedurals were doing the same things. And
right. They
wanted to like have conversations over bodies about like, you know, what did you eat last night? And why am I feeling sick? And like these things are all character related. And but it made sense. So we were proud that we were able to do that and see that. And, you know, working with Emily was a joy and just a great experience. She's phenomenal, and also somebody who was the two of us were able to really work with each other in the work environment and understand each other's moods. Like it was a long marriage, and you know what? I'm not having such a great day today. I'm telling you that right now up front.
Right.
Oh, sure. Emily goes, yeah, I understand. I respect that. I love you, man. But you know what? We'd still have that banter, and we'd still respect each other. We'd always be open with each other. We'd never hide things from each other. We're very. It just became a great match, and I was very fortunate to have that. So, but Bones was a great run, and regardless if it was an unconscious decision, I think it was smart for me at the time because you do a show like Buffy, and it's very cult oriented, and then you take the character and it gets spin off to its own series for 5 seasons, and I think Angel was a show that could have gone on a lot longer. I think that it ended a lot quicker. I think it was a different type of show. It was darker, obviously, more adult-oriented themes. I mean, a vampire living in Los Angeles saving souls. It's so, like, hilarious as soon as you think about it. I mean, it was crazy. The people that we had on it, the characters are so great.
The puppet episode.
Everyone loves the puppet.
Well, of course.
Puppet's the best.
It's a triumph. It's a television triumph. Like, that was the fun thing about both of those shows is that it was always looking for ways to have this fun subtextual conversation mm-hmm. with the audience of like, we know what you're used to seeing and we want to play with that and have fun. We want to have fun with you, the audience, and show that we are willing to break the mold sometimes, step out of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that was what, you know, Buffy really kind of started this 1996-97 mm-hmm. started this era of respecting that type of a cult audience, you know, and saying like, hey, if you were to make a show, this is the type of show you would want to make.
Yes.
And that's what it felt like.
It was very much when we went to Comic-Con, I think it was early on at 96-97, and it was just boxes of comics on the floor. There was no huge marquee advertisements for movies. It was a pure comic book convention floor, right?
Yeah.
People selling like real Superman, or, you know, everything. It was just authentic. And then now it's just kind of gravitated and you go there and everything's promoted.
Sure.
It's crazy. Everything's like a big movie or a big production and there's lights and dance. It's like, what happened here?
Well, they followed
the Wizard of Oz just blew up, man.
I know, but the entertainment industry followed the money because, you know, this sort of trend in nerd culture that, mm-hmm. you know, that Buffy was definitely one of the, for the contemporary nerd movement, planted a flag in the soil and said, this is a real audience, and it's not just niche, and it's not just a bunch of that stereotypical, they live in their mom's basement, you know, playing D&D. Hey, maybe I live in the basement of my house, and I let my mom live upstairs. Okay. You ever think of that?
All right.
So, but in any case, it... when they started realizing, like, there's a real audience here, then all the entertainment companies.
Of course.
You know, because then around 2000, 2001, you have Spider-Man, X-Men, mm-hmm. Harry Potter.
Yeah, it's great.
And I mean, so, yeah, so it all blew up. But it does go back to what you were talking about before, about that PR dance.
Yep.
Which, you're right. And I think I've always, I was saying that to my wife this morning, that I've always respected that it seems like you chose to not be a part of that, because that also... you get attention based on how, you know, how much they perceive you as being. Yeah. It's like, and that's very fluid. You have no control over that. And no. Then you're just a commodity. And that yeah. feels, that could really fuck with your head.
Yeah, because you're trying to control it.
Absolutely.
And then when you try to control it, then it just, it goes crazy. It's messy.
Yeah.
You're walking with your shoes on backwards.
Right.
You think you just create this own world inside your head that's like this fantasy world, and it's not real.
Right.
It just becomes your own dragon's lair, so to speak.
Nicely done.
It really does.
Well played.
You know, when Buffy started out and we were fortunate to get, I got on that show, I was like, I was a reoccurring character the first 13 episodes, and then it just worked. The character of Angel and Buffy, and it was a love story, and it took off. It was a very big, impactful moment for that show, and it just catapulted that love story even further up. And then yep. I'm like, hey, they want some more episodes. I'm like, sure. I'm like, I ain't doing anything. I'm like, I was living in Los Feliz with like four of my best friends that we rented this house. It was like the first original house in Los Feliz, and it was like the Sunset Boulevard. It was a plastic surgeon made this house for Charlotte Dupree, who was a silent film star.
Oh, wow.
It was in honor of his love for her. So we rented it out with all the original furniture, and it was like crazy, you know. And I was like, hey, I'm just staying here. I might as well do six more episodes of A Vampire with a Soul. I didn't care.
Yeah.
But the breakdown came out, and it was like, he's like a Joe Louis prize fighter who can take a shot, can always get back up. Like, that resonated more with me than anything else when they said, this is the character breakdown. I remember getting the role, and we had this big party in Los Feliz, and my buddies are like, dude, you're playing this vampire, man. And I'm like, yeah, it's based on this Joe Louis character who can't, that comes back and, like, doesn't take a punch. And it was just like this, all these, like, interesting metaphors going on in my head at yeah. the time. And I was just excited to be working too, and then I'd show up, and at first it was not really a lot of stuff. It was just me brooding in corners and kind of looking at her and telling her I loved her, and we created this like thing, and it blew up, and then there I am 8 episodes later, and then it turns into a series regular. I'm like, wow, this is taking off. It's crazy. And you could feel the momentum of it in a way that was like, where are we going with this? Like, when it comes out, it's popular. 6 episodes in, it gets more popular. And then it's this cult thing. And next thing you're doing a cover shoot with Rolling Stone magazine with Sarah Michelle Gellar. And there's big E! Fans in Griffith Park. And there's 9 photographers around. Everyone's drinking beers and shit. It's like, what's going on here, man? The coat's flying. I did a photo shoot with Annie Leibovitz, a milk campaign. I'm like, when Angel got to be get his own show, and I'm on harnesses, and they're like, I'm drinking milk. It's like, this is a badass job, man. This really is far from the Joe Louis guy that I didn't really imagine. So it was pretty intense. And you found yourself getting more and more into the trying to control that aspect, going to places, getting into places, and it can become a wrecking ball for your soul.
Of course, yes.
Because it's so self-identifying. Here I am playing a character who has to save souls, and here is your own soul is like going down these paths. Or like, what's going on here?
Right.
You know, and it's fascinating. And when the transition happened into my own show, I was so like, Joss is like, hey, you're going to get the show. We'll spin it off with David Greenwald. And I'm like, I was working on this Irish accent that was horrible, and I was like in character. I had long hair, and I was playing Liam, and it was like I was more focused on that. He told me, I was like, okay, great. I got to go do the scene now. Mm-hmm. Like my phase, my thing is, it's always moment to moment, never what's behind you, always the next step. Mm-hmm. And it's the way I live my life, you know, and to a fault sometimes. But, that show went on to, greater success because of the success that came from Buffy. You know, the character created itself and it just kept going and going. And the people I met, the showrunners that are now showrunners, or the writers that became showrunners, you know, David Fury, Marty Noxon, I can name tons of them that have gone on, are now successful runners of their own shows and created some great stuff. That's the best part, is really working with these writers and the people they've created such remarkable material, and the relationships you've garnished with other cast members and guest stars that have come on. They have fantastic careers. And it was always, for me, it's like when Bones, it was such a long running show, and the guest stars that come on, you'd see their careers take off. And that was always exciting to see that.
Yeah.
It was fun.
Well, and I think there's also a testament to, you know, this business will put up with a lot.
Yeah.
But I think in order to maintain a career, I've always just assumed, like, oh, David's probably a super nice guy, because someone wouldn't get show after show after show after show if they weren't fun and easy to work with.
Yeah.
Because at a certain point, the business is just like, ah, that guy's kind of a pain in the ass,
yeah,
you know? And so but hearing about how you just make it about the work, but then also mm-hmm. hearing that you went through a period where you had to learn about how insatiable the ego can be.
Yeah.
Because it's an unfillable hole.
Of course.
And some people it just fully consumes, and then some mm-hmm. people can go, oh, wait a minute,
let me take a step back.
Let me take
and
a step
see
back.
What's happening, because it's really affecting your life, or it's affecting how you feel about certain things. And yeah, of course, you go through those moments. I think to this day, you always do. For me to be blind and not say that would be stupid. I'd be lying to myself. You always are going through challenges, regardless of what that is and where you are. You know, simplicity is always the most important thing to me, and laughter is the most important thing mm-hmm. to me, and that gets me through a lot. And it's, you know, you work with these SEALs and, you know, these guys, that these real tier one operators that work these major missions, and then, you know, some of them don't make it out, and some of them do, or have their arms blown off, or they lose their legs. And I was like, well, how did you get through that moment? It's like, well, you know, just half my arm was blown off, and I'm, you know, kind of telling jokes about movie lines and getting through with laughter through pain. It's like, whoa, it's intense. Like, it's hard to comprehend it, but it makes a lot of sense. You know, I think laughter is the biggest cure for everything mm-hmm. in life. You know, I think that you need a lot of that. And of course, my dad and my mom and my family's very tight with me. So they've always helped me guide that, especially my father.
Yeah.
He's like huge, huge. He represents everything to me. You know, my dad's everything. And always there, always with no judgment, but there to, you know, strengthen the laugh gene.
Well, that's good. Yeah. And it also makes that, a lot yeah. of sense, too.
And I'm fortunate, too. I mean, look, I think you are a product of your environment. I represent like that, for which is like a kid who is trying to make it in the sports team out east, and he was brought out somewhere living and didn't have the facilities or the type of training. And then you go to the East Coast and you're competitive, and you're not as competitive because these kids are leagues ahead of you because of their environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you play a sport out here, and it's like, let's say hockey, it's not as, you know, you can't just go outside and skate in the frozen pond as you can in like the East Coast. It's like the kids are all doing it, and they're out here, you're just like, you got sun and you don't do much.
Yeah.
Know? So it's different. I mean, I think environment plays a big part of it.
Sure.
I really do.
But hearing you talk about, you know, working with SEALs and because this is the first job, it's not like you could talk to a vampire or, you know, I mean,
who says you can't talk to a vampire? Everyone's fascinated with it, so.
We talked to a lot of vampires when preparing for this role. We had to paint the windows black, you know, we asked.
Had to kind of get into it,
yeah.
And, you know, it's a whole thing.
Well, you know, sometimes you bite the person on the neck. And
we never
like
did that. No. But never got into the dialect, but yeah.
But what's so interesting is that this is a show where you're actually playing, you're representing a real group.
Yeah.
And so was there anxiety on your part of like, well, I want to make sure I'm as respectful, because you're talking to these guys and you see like they have, you know, and then you look at, you know, we look at performers who are like, oh, I guess my job's really not that, you know, what these people do to put themselves in harm's way day in, day out, sacrificing like you said, life and limb, and they, you know, and they can do it with such
a stuffing breed.
Yeah, exactly.
They are a different breed.
So was any of that, did that affect you when you first took on the role? Like, oh, I really need to make sure that we do mm-hmm. this the right way because it represents a real group.
Of course we do it the right way and we're proud of that. You know, it's something that we don't take lightly at all, and it takes a little bit of time, but when we do shoot, it's very effective and very fast. But Matt, one of the my partners on the show, executive producer with me, as well as Chris Chulak, Anna, he's someone who was on 13 deployments, Captain Phillips, Bin Laden, you know, those guys are just a different breed. Mm-hmm. And you can see it in their eyes. You can see it in the way they talk to you. And they're also very humbled and extremely just really cool, great guys to hang out with.
Yeah.
Great storytellers. And they tell you, I think, to a point, what you want to hear,
mm-hmm.
to be honest. And so you take that information. And for me, it was all really about the mind and how they function and how they compartmentalize things and how they deal with being away on deployment and coming home, you know, after a long run and, you know, putting someone's head back together or making a mission complete, they're arguing about Christmas tree lights and, mm-hmm. you know, why they have to, you know, something's not working in the kitchen and you get into an argument with your wife over the disposal the day after. It's like, whoa, that's a big flip.
Right.
And it's playing this role going into the third season. You take that on, you know, you tap into the mental aspect of what this character goes through. And from the beginning of season one, it's really starting to get darker and deeper now, or really get into his mind and how he kind of is hearing kind of those voices and the demons and his brothers that have passed away and how it's catching up to him. And when you're on that grind, you want to be as authentic as you can. So you do talk to them, you do get the stories, but you also have to bring flavor to that, right? You have to, as an actor, you get to take that information, and Ivana and I work on what is underneath all that. And mm-hmm. we decide like how to make these specific choices that, you know, these are alpha male guys. They operate 150%, you know, their engines are always going. They don't idle very well, but yet they're very methodical and slow when they're on the attack, and they operate as a team. So in operating as a team, if one function is off, then they're not going to be a team, which I love that aspect of it. So for me, it's always very sports oriented. So I use a lot of sports metaphors.
Mm-hmm. Like,
hockey team takes the ice. If you're not playing the right move or you're not in your position, stay in your lane, then things are going to go crazy and mm-hmm. it's not going to work. And that's how these guys operate. And when there's a clog off and the mission does not succeed, I think their biggest fear is failure. They don't like to fail. Like that's not accepted for them. That to them is like, it's a big gaping wound.
Mm-hmm.
When you see a physical wound, that is not as effective as a failure,
mm-hmm.
an emotional wound that opens up and stays with them. And it just festers. And, you know, they live with so much regardless of what they're dealing with, PTSD, you know, TBI, whatever that is. It just grows and grows and grows. So to your point, yeah, I did talk to the people. I did talk to Matt. I did talk to Tyler, the guys who are Delta Force guys that are on our show. I got into their heads. They're very good friends. They're brothers. We went out drinking, you know, I've had parties at my house with them. You see how they operate. You see how proud they are. When you bring out a bottle of whiskey and a bunch of tier one guys, it's an interesting night, I'll tell you that. but you learn a lot. And not to say that's like, hey, well, we just got smashed and learned. It's, you know, you don't really need to, but you can effectively find attitudes and how they adjust. And it's amazing to watch from an actor's perspective. You just take all that in, then you find yourself living it.
Right.
You find yourself immersed so much in the role, and you're really into this role and you're a part of it. And for me, Jason Hayes has been like the most immersed character I think I have ever played on all of them, because they all lead to one another in a way. For you, when you say, oh, you take bits and pieces from certain characters that you play, I fell into this role and it made sense to me and it was called to me. I gave it up. I didn't want to do it. And then it came back to me. So it made sense to me. And, mm-hmm. It just was kind of like, this needs to happen. And I fell into it and here I am, and I'm third season. I'm like, wow, this is really amazing to be a part of, but because I feel it, you know, I can do a scene. If I'm doing a scene with Ray, I'm a Bravo 2 guy, and I'm going through an issue or a problem, and I've done the work and I'm working my subtext. There's something about it that, again, it's the, you want to do them right. Right.
Right.
It's the history. It's the history of a tier one operator, of playing whatever that is, veterans in the room. You have an obligation to them, all of them. Right. Because you're playing this character and you don't want it to be, you want to be as authentic as you can.
Right.
And that becomes real and you feel it. And in these scenes, and it, for me, it's like, it's ignition. It's, you know, the spark plug goes off. I can hit a line and I'm hitting a roll and I'm on my roll with it, and it just becomes very vulnerable.
Right.
And I really enjoy that. I enjoy that feeling, that rush of intensity, or that feeling that I'm going through, because it's showing the character struggles. It's showing the character's victories. It's showing the character's involvement in bringing the team together and leadership.
Right.
And how effective leadership can be, and also the cost of leadership, and
right,
how it can change the dynamics of a team, and
right,
and the other choices that the other Bravo members are making. So it's a fascinating world, and I've just enjoying it right now. And
also understanding them as human beings too,
yes,
and not just these machines that go up.
They're
it's
not.
Like, no,
they're,
they have depth, and they have, yeah, they deal. Just the compartmentalization, mm-hmm, to me is so, especially because we, you know, I feel like our culture right now is in a state where, you know, everyone is conditioned to not ever feel an uncomfortable emotion at any given moment. Like, oh, you know, we take pills to stop that, and we do,
yeah,
this, and we, you know, we consume to forget, and we go on social media to distract, mm-hmm, and we, you know, and so, you know, to see that there are still people in the world who go, yes, the core of my job is living in a state of discomfort, seeking that, embracing it,
mm-hmm,
fighting through it, you know, yeah, is so, I have so much respect for it, and it's endlessly fascinating to me because it's antithetical to what I believe is happening a lot in our culture, mm-hmm, now, which is just a complete, you know, mm-hmm, I want my life to just be like a big pillow.
Not only that, but I want my life to be like an Instagram ad or an Instagram,
right,
person or whatever that post is. And you're,
right,
you're only as valuable as your followers.
Right.
Sounds crazy, but it's like, you know, the Starbelly Sneetches. You know, it's a thorax.
Good reference.
It's like, come on, man. Like, what's going on? You know, you got a star. I don't have a star. Well, I'll go to McMonkey McBean and I'll get a star. And then my family gets a star. And then people pulling stars off. They don't have stars. A star off machine. It's
exactly
crazy.
Well, how are you communicating? Like, you know, your kids must be teen. How old are they?
17 and 10-year-old.
Just, yeah, the weirdest time to be a young person right now, I would imagine. Because
I don't know how they do it, man. I mean, social media, blitzkrieg, the snapping, the.
It was hard enough to navigate just our own immediate social circles in schools, and I also went to an all boys school,
man.
But now you're in it with everyone in the fucking world.
No, it's intense, and it's in your scrutinized, and you're under a microscope in so many ways, and. You know, my family is, you know, to me, very private, and I keep it that way. And I don't like to kind of really divulge like what they're doing. But I will say that my son and my daughter are in very different parts of their – one's 10, one's 17. One goes to school, a boarding school out east, and he's feeling all that what I felt. You know, like growing up in the East Coast, the winters, how tough it is. Carrying your backpack full of books, you know, all boys school, like it's intense. It's, and the grind is intense, and the sports is intense. You know, it's like, wow, they're really working out hard every day for whatever that is. And not just for the physicality of it, but for the mental aspect of it, to break walls and become a young man,
right,
and learn that through the environment that you're in again. And there's my daughter who's home, and she's an equestrian rider, and she's on horses, and she's jumping now. And at 10, I'm like, this is crazy. But she adapts to the environment because she loves horses, and she's at home jumping dogs all the time. And there's our house is like got sticks all over the place. The dogs are flying. It's like a magical world, man. It's absolutely crazy. But it has been consumed with, again, the social media. They are scrutinized. They are put under a surface. Oh, your dad does this for a living, and now you're become more than just who you are. Your
right.
self-identity for them is, I have to break through that. I mean, me growing up, my dad was in television. He had a kid's show called Rocket Ship 7, and he was
like, wasn't he a weather guy too?
He was a weather guy in Philadelphia. He was a very popular guy in Philly. He was like Dave Roberts, City Lion. I got the whole thing, and I went to school, and I was like razzed or whatever, it's bully, whatever that is. Whatever you have to deal with as a kid, you got to, if you're with that, that under that umbrella of whatever comes with it, you have to find ways to navigate around it. Are you being my friend because my dad's a weather guy in Philadelphia?
Right.
Do you want to go down to the station and meet the news guy?
Well, that's like, why I wanted you on the podcast, yeah, to be honest.
Exactly.
Your dad,
you
want
to go to the Phillies game because, you know, like Don Tolleson, who was a sports guy at that time. You meet the Fanatic, like at the Sixers court. It's like crazy, man. It's, and, you know, but one thing my dad always taught me was like, he would introduce all us all. Oh, you're Dave Roberts. Oh, yeah, this is my son, David. And I'd be like, geez, really, Dad? You got to introduce me? Like, well, you're my son. And, you know, this is who they are. And you take time to talk. My dad texts to everybody.
Yeah.
It's like a Utah goodbye. Times five. They say goodbye, like, in the kitchen, in the hallway, out the doorway, in the driveway, on the corner of the driveway. No. It's like, you got to leave. I got to leave in an hour. Then you better start planning that now, because that's when you're going to get out. But also, that's taught me the simple things, handshakes and looking people in the eyes and communication with vulnerability and love and support and listening, like being able to listen to somebody without all this noise, you know, like the social media noise. And
yeah.
Like I'm just happy that my son can write cursive. Can write a letter.
Have you written?
Write me a letter.
Have you handwritten?
Yes, I have.
Lately?
I wrote a letter last week.
My handwriting, I tried to write something recently.
It's sad.
And I'm like, what happened to my handwriting? Oh, fuck, you got to practice this.
It'd be nice to all go to handwriting school. You got the ink, and you get the pen and the quill.
It's calligraphy.
Amazing.
Yeah.
It's really, and then I have my nephew, he doesn't write cursive. I'm like, how do you not do that? Like, they're not, it's not how they were trained.
Well, this pen doesn't autocorrect itself. I don't know how to.
Yeah, but you got blue, green.
Yeah, I've got the four-color pen.
That's your autocorrect right there.
My autocorrect is, yeah, scraping out. I mean, I remember having to take, you know, I had to take typing in like seventh grade.
I remember that.
And we were on these non-electric,
yes,
like Mad Men era, you know, tick, 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 tick.
Yep.
And if you fucked up, you had to go back and put in like
the little white thing
and
hit it,
redo the letter.
Yep.
And so there was no safety net. There was no room for a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And it was incredibly stressful.
Yeah. I mean, safety nets are another, it brings up for me, is like, you know, you'd go out and audition for roles and you have an acting teacher, it'd be like, oh, you're coaching with them to go to audition for something. He's like, yeah, well, you have to have that safety net because if you fuck up, then you have this to go to.
Right.
Which I kind of understand, but I also was like, hey, maybe if you don't have a safety net, you'll fall and you'll find another place that'll be more interesting than what you just tried. You
right.
Know? That's always by choice too, but there's a lot of safety nets today.
Embracing falling is a great thing to learn. I'm not saying I'm great at it, but it is. Because I feel like if you can embrace the fall, you're relatively unstoppable in life because you're constantly in a state of growth and learning and like, okay, I'm not afraid. You know, I had a friend in grade school who was not a particularly big guy, but he just wasn't afraid to fight because he wasn't afraid to get hit in the face.
Right.
And so he was actually not a big kid, but considered a tough kid. Only because he was not afraid to get hit and he was not afraid to throw a punch.
Yeah.
And I was afraid of both of those things. And so it feels like a skill set that if you could adapt that in your life, then you really could get through pretty much anything.
A lot. When you look at these people, like I remember as a kid, I always wanted a skateboard. And my mom was like, you're not getting a skateboard. You're going to crack your head. But you can go play ice hockey. I'm like, well, okay, really? Or you can go play football. I'm like, okay.
What?
That's all right. What's going on? I remember playing soccer as a kid, and I picked the ball up and started running, and my dad's like, you're in the wrong sport. I put you in football.
But it'll just move you one field
fall,
over.
Like, for me, you remember the East Coast and the cold and playing in the dirt. I remember playing football games, and there was no grass. It was dirt and stones, and you got your knees chopped up and your elbows cut up. But it was like you came out of like it's like a war.
Yeah.
And like you said, you go through these falls and this pain, but you get back up.
Yeah.
And you learn how to get back up. And that's why I'm very happy and proud of my son to be on the East Coast, to be able to experience that and getting cut up metaphorically by, you know, the East Coast mentality and the weather and, you know, the way they live out there compared to how they live on the West Coast. So different.
Yeah.
So that's a blessing for him. And a blessing for my daughter to be able to get on a 1,000-pound animal and take off. And she said that to me the other day. She's like, "Dad, I'm an athlete. I ride a 1,000-pound animal." I'm
seriously?
Like, "Wow,
yeah, hey. Yeah." And not only does she ride that, but she tells the animal what to do.
I was like, "Bella, do you know first season of Angel? My character got on a horse. It was a black stallion. I have a picture of it, and I rode downtown on a street, no lie, like full gallop with a lance in my hand."
Yeah.
I did that one take, and the line producer was like, "Get him off that fucking horse right now. I'll fucking kill you. Never again." Because I was like, "Kelly, I'm fucking going to go." And I was like, "Yeah." And the fucking horse was like, "Clum, clum, 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 clum." And I was charging. The coat was flying. And I was like, "Remember, stop." I was like, "Fuck, yeah, it was awesome." And Kelly was like, "Get the fuck off that horse. If you're my fucking horse, you get injured. This show is fucking over." And I'm like, "Okay."
There's an alternate timeline where that David didn't survive that horse. You know?
Probably is. But I do. I find myself actively always being involved in the roles. I mean, Bones wasn't really a stunt-oriented show. I was like, I always said to them, "You're not really utilizing my capability here.
Can I just ride a horse through this lab? Like,
I can ride a horse through the lab. Everybody would be happy, you know?" But because it was a war relationship. And then when I got to SEAL team, it was like, wow, you know, you got to keep your body going. You have to keep your mindset with your workouts and intensity of it. You know, I just turned 50, so you have to maintain your workouts and your eating habits, and you're constantly grinding that out. And you wake up and you're sore. It's like North Dallas 40.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You wake up, you can't. It's like, what did I just get hit with?
Yeah.
I mean, putting on the gear and the guns and the helmet and trucking on long nights for 3 days out in location in the middle of the night. Going in up and down stairs and low crawls. It's like, I don't know. Man, I don't know how they did it, man. I don't know how those guys do it, because they have an unspoken language, but they're also in, you know, what's really interesting about these guys is they blend in, you know. They all have beards. They all like, they're not military cut guys. They kind of wear t-shirts and they're hang out. And all of a sudden, they're like, "Whoa, where'd that guy come from?"
Right.
He's like a ninja, dude. Serious fucking ninja. He's a superhero without a cape. He's not in front of a green screen. He's not wired up, and he's doing serious shit that's protecting the world, like us, the country, to be free to wake up and make scrambled eggs and walk outside without bombs. Like, these guys are doing that.
Yeah.
And again, back to your points, like, that's why you want to get it right. That's why you want to scratch those surfaces. And if I can, with this character, cast some light in these shadows of their minds where they struggle in society, where they're not accepted or not understood, then I'm doing my job.
Well, and it's also the ability to learn how to, like, with, you know, putting on all the gear, these guys that you're talking about, is just being comfortable with discomfort and pain.
Yes.
Like, I have such a low threshold for pain. My wife...
Well, I do too.
my wife will, like, you know, like, recently... I kind of noticed she turned her head weird, and I go, "What's wrong?" She goes, "Oh, I pinch a nerve in my neck." And I go, "When did you do that?" And she was like, "Like 4 days ago." I go, "You didn't say anything. You seemed fine." And she was like, "Yeah, what good would it do?" And I'm like, "How do you do that?" You know, like, the first point that would have happened to me, I'd have been like, "I can't get out of bed.
Of course.
Can you bring me a thing?
Of course
I need,
you can.
I need anti-inflammatories. I need, you know." And so some people just have the ability to embrace the pain and not. And push through anyway. And that fascinates me.
I agree with you. And I think that that's one of their things, is their adrenaline is so high that they can push through. The pain kind of actually motivates them. I was the pilot we were shooting in the Tyler Graves Delta Force guy. I was coming off of a chopper rope, and he was coming down and he slipped on the take, and he was so fucking mad. I'm like, "Dude, why are you so mad?" He wouldn't talk to me. He's like, he was so upset that he disappointed the whole routine. Like, he took it so to a degree, because these guys, again, will not accept failure.
Right.
They push through pain, like you said, and they're very good, and they're fast too. They're fucking multi-fast. I mean, those guys can fucking run. Like, they just like gazelles just taking off, man. And some of them are just rhinos, you know, like AJ Buckley plays the guy who's kind of like the grunter of the fucking team. And he's funny. He's from Texas. And you know, those guys are like rhinos, man.
Right?
They're like coming at you, and they're burling through.
You got to break through a wall.
Yeah, you got to break through walls, and they got the big guns. You know, like they're the knuckle draggers. They
right.
carry the ammo.
Right.
You know, I'm leading a team. I'm compartmentalizing. I'm talking to,
you know, the Havoc base, where we're at, how I'm going to do that. Then I'm talking to them and telling them what to do, and we're taking charge. So it's kind of like Mousetrap, the game. It's
yes.
a perfect example.
Perfect.
Man. It's like you don't want
to
get
never
the
get
mouse
that fucking game to work.
Never.
Not one time.
Every time you had it set up perfectly, if you breathed wrong, the thing would fucking fall.
Yeah, or it would start to fall. The cage would fall, and then it would stop. You're like, why'd it stop?
I don't know. It was very frustrating. Those Milton Berle games were very frustrating, right?
Back in your dad's day, entertainment was much different.
It was a much different dynamic, but it was also like it was like the Big Tracks when that thing came out. I remember wanting this thing for Christmas. It was this robot thing. It was Big Tracks. And you'd program the back of it, and it was. Do you remember the Big Tracks?
Was it like a little?
I can't believe you don't remember.
Like a little tanky robot?
Yes, it was a tank robot.
Yeah,
came
remember.
With the thing on the back that would dump the apple.
Yes.
The commercial. The dad's like reading the newspaper.
You can dump one thing at a time.
Yeah, and the commercial's like the kid's like beep 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 beep, and then this thing takes off like the pod and this in Steve Austin episode when he was fighting the pod that was indestructible, and it would go down the hallway, take a right, and the cat would look up at this thing, and they'd fire at the cat lasers, and then it would go by the dad, and it would drop the apple to the dad. And we would turn home.
Yes.
I was like, what the fuck is that toy? I was like, I want that. And my dad's like, we can't afford it. I'm like, Dad, Mom, it's all I wanted, man. It was Big Tracks. And I remember getting it. And all I did was go up and down the hallway because we didn't have this cool house to do anything.
Yeah.
Wouldn't go downstairs.
Nope.
And eventually I programmed it to go down the stairs and it broke and it flipped. And
well, I follow an Instagram account. I want to make sure and I reference it correctly, but it's called Saturday Morning Cartoons.
Oh, that's cool.
And it basically is, Saturday _ Morning Cartoons. And so it shows a lot of old clips of cartoons and then the commercials.
Yeah.
And so you see
that's
all these.
That's great.
You see all these.
The Chuck Wagon.
Yeah, you see all these old commercials.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And from when you were a kid or watching cartoons or whatever. And all the commercials for the toys, I'm like, that commercial is basically the one thing that toy does. And when you get it home, you realize, fuck, this doesn't do anything else.
It really doesn't, but they sold it so
great. Well,
it's so good.
Yeah.
But I mean, for me, it was like Creature Double Feature.
Yep.
Okay. It was Hilarious House of Frankenstein, which was Vincent Price did the opening to that. And Billy Van played all the creatures, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was awesome, man. He played the Wolfman, he played the Dracula dude, he played Frankenstein. But the opening to that was Vincent Price's glowing head coming at you, man. It was. Do you remember that show?
No, I don't remember that one.
Hilarious House of Frankenstein. One of the best Saturday morning shows. Billy Van.
Okay.
You will love this show.
I'm going to find this on the internet.
The best.
I don't know how I missed this.
This is a classic. Well, I'm Buffalo, Toronto, Canada.
Gotcha.
Really kind of very popular up there.
Was it a regional show? Maybe it was a regional show. That's why.
Great
that's why
show.
I missed it.
And then it was like on to, you know, the Creature Double Feature and Godzilla.
Yep.
You
yep.
know, and whatever he was fighting.
Yep.
You know, all those kind of things. So.
Yeah. It was there. I feel like. The nostalgia thing, because we talked earlier about how everything gets remade. It's just because, you know, the world is so overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
And all information is – we just can't process all of it.
No.
And there's something – it's taking us back to that simpler time. Mm. I don't know if you ever watched South Park, but there was a whole arc on a season of these things called member berries. And there were these berries that people would eat and they would just
cool.
go, hey, member Chewbacca. And then be like, oh, and then they would just zone out because it was just all, you know, nostalgia.
They
and
were that's just taking mushrooms, man. Pretty much.
But it is.
Ithaca, New York, man.
Yeah,
it reminds
yeah.
me of my Ithaca college days.
Yeah, because, I mean,
not
obviously,
the mushrooms, but kind of.
No, of course. Yeah, maybe a little bit. But, of course, it's you know, of course we had problems when we were kids and we had stuff. But we've removed all that, and it just seems like, oh, that simpler time when everything was just, you know, a guy with fucking cotton balls on his face saying he was a wolf man with bad effects. Like
cotton balls on his face.
Well, those regional monster people, you know, like they really made it. Did your dad ever do a regional monster? I know he did a regional kids show.
Rocket Ship 7, but never did like the monster thing. But he had like a robot. He had puppets. Like it was pretty badass, man.
That's fantastic.
It was kind of cool to grow up like total Rumpelstiltskin in the garage, you know, with my two older sisters. Waiting for my dad to come home because my mom was upset with us. So I don't know what was going on. So we waited for dad to come home. And so we had all of his stuff in the garage. And, you know,
can't touch this stuff. It's, you know, of course I'd go up and be like, whoa, what's all this? You know? And it was like walking into, I think that's why I'm so fascinated by this place, is you see all these things and these trinkets and these fabulous little pieces. And it's like, that's the world I was kind of like growing up as a kid with my dad. He was a traveling kind of circus act in his own way,
you know,
with a, had a robot in the back seat of his station wagon. And I would go and do appearances with him up in Toronto and travel from Buffalo to Toronto. And the guy would put on the robot suit that looked like a big dishwasher and the big shoes. And, you know, and then he'd put the puppet on. Mr. Beeper would come out. And I'm like, dude, this is so amazing. You know? I was like, to watch all this is, you know, and my father had to pack it back up and he'd get paid $30.
Oh my gosh.
And you're like, all that work for that. Or just enough money to, so I can buy the kids Christmas presents.
Right.
And in Buffalo and cold New York and the snow and the blizzard of 76 and 77. I mean, just remarkable families. I was talking to somebody the other day about how it was great just to be around all that. And I think the closeness of the families and going to the house because they had the pool and they had the construction company. So they were like rich, man. They had the pool and they had like the exercise machine downstairs that you'd put on. It was like this bike thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah, silver with the handles.
Yeah, I was what is that, man? Yeah. It's like as a kid, you're like, holy shit, let's press that on. Off.
Yeah.
Thing goes crazy. But I think that's all growing up in that, around that area, again, environment for me. And it's who I am today in a lot of ways. It's the types of roles and I like to play. It's like, again, I'm attracted to the hero within, the Joseph Campbell type of roles. And I believe Jason Hayes is a hero in his own right because he's doing a journey. And that journey is going to take him to a lot of dark places that people are going to see and be like, you know what, thank you for that. Thank you, because it shines a light that people don't understand, you know.
Well, what are you, just as we're wrapping this up, what are you excited about? Is there anything in particular in general that, you know, that gives you hope for the world, that makes you happy, is kind of your happy place?
I feel it's though, you know, happiness isn't a smile, a kind gesture, staying away from the social media blitz, writing a letter, going out and seeing the ocean, going to a lake. Lakes to me are just great. People, conversations at old diners, a piece of apple pie. Always, my mom has said, if you're having a bad day, have a banana split. Yeah. That's what I'm happy about. Seeing my kids progress in a way that is, you know, adversity for them first and foremost, and challenging themselves. That to me is exciting, but it's very daunting times right now. So, see how that all plays in today's world.
Well, you're doing a great job, and it was a real pleasure to meet you. And,
thank you.
You know, again, I've been watching you for years, and as a diehard Buffy fan moving forward, you know, and but then also understanding how the business works, like that David Boreanaz is doing something right. Must be doing something right.
I'm trying.
Because that shit's not an accident. You know, anyone can get one good – anyone can luck into a job.
Yeah.
But to maintain success over, you know, decades is – that's a separate skill set. Mm-hmm. To keep your head on straight, to navigate all the shit and stay focused. And I think just distilling it down to what you said, you just make it about the work.
All
and if you make
work,
it about
man.
The work – and you're nice to people, and you appreciate what you have, there isn't much more to really do beyond that. And all the other stuff is, you know.
It'd be nice one day just to sit by the lake and read a book. I look forward to that, man. And not having a call time.
You know, you say that, and I say that to my wife all the time, like, what if we just got a ranch and just had animals?
It'd be loving for like a week.
That's what she said.
And I'd be like, I'm driving myself crazy.
God, what am I going to do?
I don't have hobbies. Yeah. That's the problem.
Sweetheart, can you just shoot Daddy like diving out of the barn? Just use my phone. Dad just wants to dive out of it. I'm going to light the barn on fire. I'm going to dive out of it. Dad, please. Take it easy.
Arthur Fonzarelli couldn't build the birdhouses. There's no way David Boreanaz is building them either.
Very parallel career, by the way, because Fonzie was supposed to just have an episode.
Yeah.
And then he ended up becoming kind of the focal point of that show. So,
and he's a great guy.
And a great guy, Henry Winkler.
Henry Winkler's great.
Yeah, but thank you so much for being here, man. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Nice to see you. And thank you for tolerating my Sunnydale Razorbacks shirt.
That's good, man.
All right. The end.
That was the ID10T podcast number 1031 with David Boreanaz. It's time for Idiot Rap. That's what I'm calling it this week, y'all. That's what it is right now. Who knows what it'll be?
Good branding. Change a name every week. So there was a lot of talk in this episode, which I really enjoyed, about like pushing through discomfort. And discomfort is already not a fun sounding term. No one wants to be uncomfortable, though sometimes it is necessary if you want to get some shit done. Now, that doesn't necessarily have to mean like physical discomfort. It's even emotional discomfort. I feel like we might avoid emotional discomfort more because we do encounter that more in our day-to-day lives. Just things we don't feel like doing, especially if you've been working all day and when there's stuff that you need to clear out, whether it's your garage. So in my case, it was my office, all right? My office sort of became a repository for just a lot of stuff that I didn't know what to do with. I didn't want to make a decision about something in a moment, so it just got stacked in my office. Or if I left it somewhere else in the house, it would just magically appear in my office. Lydia! Although she had every right to do that because it was just my thing that was cluttering up some other part of the house. She's like, I'll put it in your office, and then you'll have to sort it sooner or later. And eventually, she did what an amazing partner does, which is she applied some pressure. She was like, look, you've got to clean out your office. There are pillars of things everywhere, and it looks hoardy. You're almost looking like a hoarder in your office. And I go, okay. I just didn't know what to do with that stuff. It's very uncomfortable to think about it. That means I have to make decisions to get rid of things. And, you know, the problem with Marie Kondoing my life is that a lot of things I pick up bring me joy. So it is difficult to know what to get rid of. So, again, thankfully, because Lydia is the most amazing and perfect partner ever, she said, I'm going to help you. We're just going to get in there and do it. Now, I probably put this off for a good year, like a calendar year at least. And then finally, one day, without really thinking about it, we just started tackling it. And so a couple ways that I did that was I knew it was not going to be fun. And I told myself that I didn't have to do it all at once. Again, I did have the help of Lydia, which was tremendously, tremendously helpful. And we just made stacks of things. Okay, all these things are going to the podcast room. This is going here. This is all trash. This is a donate pile. And, you know, like after we would work on it for like a half hour. Okay, great. Let's sort all the stuff that we put in the hallway. We put all that where that was going to go. Then we go back in. And, you know, after two or three or four sessions, it was finally done. And it feels great. This is me walking around my office. There was no room to do that before. I was stepping over shit. So it wasn't until I embraced the fact that it was going to be uncomfortable. There was discomfort. And it's just that emotional thing. It's the same kind of emotional discomfort you feel when you can't figure out what you want to watch on Netflix or Apple TV or whatever, because you look at stuff and you go, oh, I don't know if I'm going to enjoy that. I don't know if I want to take a risk of watching that and then I don't like it and then it's not comfortable. See, because we're just so programmed to feel like we have to 100% like everything that we consume all the time, all the way through. And so in that case, we just go, you know, let's watch something for 10 minutes. If we're not into it, we can bounce. So I guess where I'm going with all this is that there are probably a lot of things in your life that you want to achieve, things that you need to tidy up, things that you need to sort out, and you're just avoiding it because you know it's not going to feel fun. And as long as you can accept that and you can tell yourself, you know, I don't have to do it all at once, and you force yourself to push through it anyway, any little exercises you can do to embrace that kind of emotional discomfort will make you stronger. Because then once you do it, you just sort of realize like, oh yeah, it'll be uncomfortable for like 5 minutes and then I'll just be in it, you know? And also forgiving yourself like, yeah, I don't have to do this all at once. I don't have to, you know, I'll do it. And then if it becomes so unbearable, then I will give myself a break. But at least if I just start it. You know, it's so funny. It's what I tell people all the time about like comedy or writing or any creative project. Yeah, you just got to start. So how do you get through stuff that's uncomfortable? You just got to start it. You just got to run the discomfort marathon. But then once you do it, it's done. And then you can put that little feather in your cap. You can not put that little endorphin rush notch under your belt and feel good about yourself. Because, you know, when you accomplish things that you don't feel like doing, you do it. It does send that little message to you also for your own self-esteem. Like, hey, I was worth it. I was worth it enough to do this thing that you know, helped create some space in my life, or just, you know, allowed me to, you know, embrace some responsibility, like cleaning my office. And so that's all I would do. Break it down into digestible little chunks if you need to, so you don't have to do it all at once. And just, you know, each day, you know, like one or two little things that kind of embrace discomfort. And then after that, you know, because once you can conquer that, then, you know, a lot of things, I'd say most things in life, you be able to push through, you know? Most uncomfortable things in life are not of the tragedy variety. Most of them are just annoying. So if you could just check off the little annoying discomforts and not allow yourself to just want to feel super, you know, at ease and just comfort all the time, then you will be able to accomplish great things. That is a skill set that you will apply in many other areas of your life. So thank you so much for listening. I appreciate you. I hope you're able to get through something that's slightly uncomfortable for you today and get stronger. Make a stronger you for tomorrow. All right. I'll see you in your ears next week, and have a great weekend, if it's the weekend, or a great day. Ah, oh, well, I really did not stick this landing. Then now this is uncomfortable, but I'm getting through it. All right. Goodbye.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.